True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
What illnesses did your mom say that you had?
Asthma, epilepsy, hearing impaired, vision impaired, fed with a feeding tube, paralyzed from the waist down, slow, retardation. If we'd be going to the doctor, she would do all the talking. I'd always have a stuffed animal or a Barbie doll. She'd just tell me, just play with my Barbie doll. If the doctor would come to examine me, just stay in the wheelchair, be calm, play with your doll, and don't move your legs. I was just as much in the dark as everybody else. The only thing I knew is that I could walk. As for everything else, the leukemia, the epilepsy, I was taking medication that she said was cancer medicine. She would shave my head and say, well, it's going to fall out anyway, so let's just keep it nice and neat. I just went on blind faith that a mother knows best.
Dee Dee essentially lied to the doctor. Mentally, Gypsy is behind. She's at the level of a 7-year-old on mother's information. And this is something that you see almost across all of the records is upon mother's information, upon history by mother. So she's talking to the doctor here, and she's talking about how she has mental and developmental delays, needs assistance. Apparently, while holding her hands over Gypsy's ears so as not to offend history of mental retardation, 7-year-old level per mom. And so this was the one time where a doctor actually put in the record that Dee Dee's got her hands over Gypsy's ears. So Gypsy can't even hear what mom is telling the doctor.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Now, one thing I've learned since doing this podcast is that things aren't always what they appear to be. The story of Gypsy Rose Blanchard, a victim of Munchausen syndrome by proxy and a convicted killer, has gained international attention and invited speculation from lay people as well as professionals in the medical community. On the night of June 14, 2015, deputy sheriffs in Greene County, Missouri, found the body of Dee Dee Blanchard, face down in the bedroom of her house. She was lying on her bed in a pool of blood from the multiple stab wounds that had killed her days earlier. There was no sign of her daughter, Gypsy Rose, who was believed to have suffered from leukemia, asthma, muscular dystrophy, mental retardation, and other chronic conditions. The neighbors who notified the police after reading alarming Facebook posts earlier that evening suggested that Dee Dee may have fallen victim to foul play. They were also fearful that Gypsy Rose, whose wheelchair and abundance of medications were still in the house, may have been abducted. Police found Gypsy Rose the next day in Wisconsin, where she had traveled with a boyfriend she met online. There was public outrage that someone had taken advantage of this severely disabled girl and killed her mother, until it was revealed that Gypsy was not sick at all, but in fact a victim of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Further investigation found that many of the doctors who had examined Gypsy Rose did not find any evidence of illness. Dee Dee had lied about her daughter's condition, and she'd benefited from charities such as Habitat for Humanity, Ronald McDonald House, and the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Dee Dee had been making her daughter pass herself off as younger, disabled, and chronically ill. Throughout her childhood, she'd been subjecting Gypsy to unnecessary surgery and medication, controlling her as she aged with physical and psychological abuse. This case brings up many questions of how this happened. How did Dee Dee manipulate doctors and everyone around her to keep Gypsy as her captive? And how much can we blame Gypsy for being willing to kill for her freedom? There's so much history to dig through to understand this case. I'm happy you're here to help with medical aspects, Dick, which are abundant. As a pediatrician, I feel like your experience here is invaluable. Still, I know you are not just an expert in child health, but an expert in craft beer. So let's get our beer reviewed and poured, and then we're going to head down to the quiet end to discuss the story of Gypsy Rose Blanchard.
Quite an introduction, Jill.
Hey, you deserve it.
I'll try to live up to it. So we're going to do a beer called Saison Brett from Boulevard Brewing Company in Kansas City, Missouri. So it's a Saison. These are beers that are brewed in the wintertime, meant to be consumed during the summer. It's a pretty complex style. For the most part, they tend to be earthy, tart, spicy, sometimes fruity, and on the drier side. So these are definitely summer beers. This particular one, Saison Brett, is a nice, pretty gold color with this huge, fluffy white head that left a lot of lace. So it's a very visually appealing beer. It has a citrus aroma and sort of that barnyard funky stuff, you know, horse blankets, hay. I mean, it sounds ugly, but it really brings out a good aroma in the beer.
Yeah, it does.
So there's a lemon flavor, some spices, and the aforementioned funk. So this is a very crisp, refreshing beer, pretty much world-class among Saisons.
So it kind of gives you that feeling like you just plowed a field and you're getting refreshed.
Right.
Neat.
You
know,
you've been out doing some manual labor.
Yeah.
And you need something light and refreshing. And this fills the bill.
Awesome.
This fits the bill.
I like it. Well, let's open it up.
Okay.
And we'll try it out. Oh, it looks so light and crisp. Let's head down to the quiet end.
Yeah, it is pretty quiet today. I guess people are licking their wounds from the big blowout that was Black Friday. Now, just to let people know, though, we got here 10 minutes after the place opened, and it was already packed because there was about 30 dark beers on tap.
Yeah, and good ones, right?
Oh, God, what an experience.
Well, what got me is how they had different times that each one would be released. Like, you had to be there at a certain time for the release of a certain beer.
For certain special ones,
yeah. And people showed up,
Yeah.
People are into that.
Oh, yeah. It was a good time.
Yeah.
Thanks for being my designated driver.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's get on with this story. Dee Dee Blanchard, Gypsy's mom. She was born Claudine Pitre in Chack Bay, Louisiana, which is a place near the Gulf Coast, in 1967. And she grew up with her family in nearby Golden Meadow, Louisiana. Now, during her childhood, she would occasionally engage in petty theft, often as a retaliation when things did not go her way. She attempted, allegedly, to kill her stepmother by poisoning her, and she had other accusations of criminal activity. So Dee Dee sounds like a fine, upstanding citizen.
Troubled human being.
Okay. At some point in her adult life, early on in her adult life, she worked as a nurse's aide. Now, her family has expressed suspicion that she may have killed or hastened her own mother's death. She died in 1997, and the allegation was that Dee Dee starved her. According to Dee Dee's father, Clyde, Dee Dee was a lot like her mother. Mom was a shoplifter, also stole money from family members. Now, Dee Dee lived with her mother, and some family members believed that she had killed her. After the mom died, family members noted that she was dirty and emaciated, and they thought Dee Dee might have wanted her dead. And that's probably not a far-fetched notion.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a hell of an accusation.
It is, but she was the main caretaker because she was the nurse's aide.
True.
And the condition of mom was not really good.
No, she probably didn't do a good job taking care of her, for sure. Now, when Dee Dee was 24, she had met 17-year-old Rod Blanchard at a local bowling alley, and they dated for several weeks, and she became pregnant. Rod asked Dee Dee to marry him, thinking that was the right thing to do. They named their daughter Gypsy Rose, since Dee Dee liked the name Gypsy, and Rod was a fan of the band Guns N' Roses.
Well, that's as good a reason to name a child as any, I guess, right?
Yeah, especially when you're 17.
Now, there's also some play on that that they probably didn't recognize, but Gypsy Rose Lee was a famous burlesque performer. That might have been something, too.
Well, it does have that kind of burlesqueness about it, right?
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So just before Gypsy Rose's birth in July of 1991, the couple separated. They weren't married very long. Rod said he realized he had got married for the wrong reasons. Well, yeah, that's a good decision. At least he cut out early.
I guess, yeah.
He also said that he'd made a mistake early on. He was only 18, for one thing. But Dee Dee was also very odd, and she made him feel quite uncomfortable. There was just some kind of darkness about her.
Yeah, he said she talked about witchcraft, and she had a pet tarantula. She was angry at him when he left her. Despite her efforts to get him to return, he didn't. And she took her newborn daughter to live with her family. Now, Bobby Petra, Dee Dee's nephew, has told investigators that Gypsy's birth might have been slightly premature, possibly affecting the development of her skull, but other than that, she had no known health issues. According to Rod, who remained involved with his daughter at this point, by the time Gypsy Rose, who was known in her extended family as Gyp, was 3 months old, her mother was convinced the infant girl suffered from sleep apnea, and she began taking her to the hospital frequently.
Well, this is an early pattern, isn't it? Or
yes.
The start of an early start of a pattern.
Absolutely.
I should have said it that way. And this is, in terms of people with Munchausen by proxy, this is one of the early things that they're going to complain about. Because who's going to doubt that? I mean, it's a convincing story. My baby's having apneic spells.
Well, so, there's that, and there's the people who cause apneic spells on their babies, and that's a whole other thing.
Well, yeah, we've talked about that guy, too.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he's not the only guy.
Right. But this is something that's a common complaint for infants early on in parents who suffer from Munchausen by proxy, okay? So they're thinking, oh, geez, apneic spells, near miss, sudden infant death, or what they call an apparent life-threatening event. These are serious things.
Well, they're attention-getting things,
too. They sure are.
You get a lot of attention for that. Gypsy did have repeat testing, where overnight stays with a sleep monitor and other tests found no sign of that condition. Still, Dee Dee became convinced that Gypsy had major health issues, which she said were due to an unspecified chromosomal disorder. Despite the lack of any evidence of sleep apnea, Dee Dee was able to procure an apnea monitor to put on Gypsy at night. From there, things escalated. Dee Dee said that Gypsy had reflux. She was given medications, and ultimately a feeding tube was placed.
Yeah, so there's a couple other things here.
Okay.
So after apnea and procuring an apnea monitor, which these days isn't done.
But it was in the 90s?
In the 90s, it was kind of fading out of preference.
I'm betting she really pushed for it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And they probably, this is putting words in people's mouth, but they figured, I think, maybe if we give her an apnea monitor, she'll stop bringing her kid to the ER all the time.
Okay, so you're kind of saying what you would think if you were the doctor doing it.
Maybe.
Because you don't know what that doctor was thinking.
I don't. But I think it's an easy thing to say, well, why don't we get an apnea monitor for her and we can see if she's truly having apneic spells.
Okay, and most people know what reflux is.
Now, reflux is food coming up from the stomach into the esophagus.
And don't most babies have a certain degree of that?
Most babies have some degree of reflux.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's silent. They don't have any symptoms. Sometimes they spit, the typical spitty baby. Sometimes they're irritable because they're having some heartburn symptoms. So those are things that are fairly common in infants.
Reflux can cause a baby to have apnea, can't it?
Yes.
They can choke on their spit up.
So she was given medications, and that's fairly typical. I mean, you look at a kid with reflux or possible reflux. So somebody comes in and says, my baby spits all the time. So are they gaining weight? That's the first thing. If they are, it's less of an issue because they're going to outgrow the reflux symptoms. So you don't worry too much for a growing baby. And then the second thing, are they what we call happy spitters? So there's babies that spit and they're fine, and there's babies that spit and they're terribly irritable. So the irritable ones, after you maybe try some diet changes in terms of changing formula or eliminating certain foods from mom's diet if she's breastfeeding, would be to try a medication, kind of using an acid blocker, which will help with the symptoms of fussiness and those kind of heartburn symptoms.
Mm-hmm. So, Dick, I really want to talk about the feeding tube. How did this woman get that done to her baby? You know, it seems like it's just a must-have for Munchausen moms to have that feeding tube.
Well, kind of is, because it gives them more control over the child's diet, right?
They can put anything in there.
Can do anything. But from a physician standpoint, if I'm seeing a kid who purportedly has reflux, and I've tried diet manipulations and I've tried medication and they're still having reflux, perhaps a feeding tube would be something to consider. I think if they're gaining weight, I'm less inclined to do a feeding tube. Or I would be less inclined to recommend a feeding tube, because obviously I'm not going to put the feeding tube in.
So there'd be a referral to...
There'd be a referral to a surgeon. Because when they're talking feeding tube, it's not just passing a tube through the mouth into the stomach or through the nose into the stomach. It's inserting it into the stomach or into the small intestine to give nutrition to the infant.
Right, right through the abdominal wall.
Right.
So it's a surgery.
It's a surgery.
It's very invasive.
Yeah, well, it's fairly simple surgery, but it is surgery, and it would require anesthesia.
Yes, and then it has to be changed periodically.
Yep, it does.
Well, my mind just goes back to the Lacey Spears case and how she poisoned that baby through the feeding tube.
Well, yeah.
And I feel like...
Like you said, you can put anything through the feeding tube.
Yeah, so I feel like if you're a Munchausen by proxy mom, that's what you're going to go for. So I'm just thinking that should be a red flag to physicians if someone wants their baby to have that. That's odd.
It is, and particularly if the infant is growing.
Yes.
I mean, even if they have the worst symptoms in the world, but they're gaining weight, most people wouldn't opt for a feeding tube.
Well, there is the possibility, because we haven't seen the medical record, that maybe she wasn't gaining weight.
Sure.
Her mom could have been starving her.
Again, that's an easy thing to manipulate. You could withhold feeds and the baby could be not gaining weight well.
Yeah, feed water instead of formula.
Yeah.
Lots of things.
So that could have happened.
Well, when Gypsy was about 7 years old, she was riding on her grandfather's motorcycle when he had a minor accident, and she suffered an abrasion to her knee, which Dee Dee said was the only visible sign of injuries that would require several surgeries. From then on, Gypsy was confined to a wheelchair. Although there were signs that she was able to walk, there were several witnesses that could see that she could bear weight.
Yeah, she's had many times, many instances where she was upright and able to weight bear.
Yeah, and Dee Dee's excuse was, well, it flares up and goes away.
Sure.
Right. So she was taken to the Special Olympics events. In 2001, she was named the honorary queen of the crew of Mid-City Parade, a child-oriented parade held during Mardi Gras in New Orleans.
And now Gypsy stopped going to school after the second grade, but maybe even earlier, maybe as early as kindergarten. And her mom homeschooled her after that, supposedly because her illnesses were so severe. So there's another red flag in terms of evaluating a child that you might suspect is a victim of factitious illness, where by keeping her at home, mom gets to exert more control over things.
Yes, and this mom was certainly wanting to have control of this child.
Right. We find out later on that, according to Gypsy, she taught herself to read by looking at Harry Potter books.
So she's really quite an intelligent person. If you listen to her interviews, for someone who's only had a second grade education, she is fairly well-spoken.
She certainly is.
Yeah. Now, Dee Dee told Gypsy's father that Gypsy had multi-system illnesses that were related to this supposed chromosomal disorder. She would need to be fed by feeding tube, take multiple medications, and use supplemental oxygen. She told Rod that Gypsy would not live beyond her teen years. This was very shocking and disturbing to him. And he had to accept that his daughter would never have a normal life and probably wouldn't be around into adulthood.
Yeah, so, now I don't know where the supplemental oxygen came in. Is that from her asthma that
she
supposedly had?
It's just shocking to me they got that, too.
Yeah, because that's something you can easily measure.
Yes.
I mean, you're looking at a child and you can measure the oxygen content of their blood by a thing called pulse oximetry, and you can tell how well they're oxygenated. So I don't know how you can finagle that one and get supplemental
oxygen.
Well,
I'm thinking if they're in the hospital, the nurse leaves the room. You take it off and you pretend it alarmed. I mean, it all depends how much you're going to listen to the mother.
True.
Because most of the times you have to listen to the mother to a certain extent.
Well, you depend on the mother to give an accurate history.
Yeah.
Or the father, the caretaker.
And if they're not, well, you can be waylaid.
You can. So Dee Dee made really exceptional efforts to keep Gypsy in her role as a young child. As long as Gypsy was dependent on her, Dee Dee would be able to control her and use her for attention and financial gain. She told Rod and others that Gypsy's mental capacity was severely delayed at the level of a 5 to 7 year old. And this is when she's in her teens. And she also falsified her age.
Yeah, she had false birth certificates.
Yeah.
Now, in her early 20s, Gypsy dressed and acted about like a 10-year-old. Since she was encouraged to behave as a disabled child and punished when she seemed well or acted closer to her actual age, there had to be so much confusion in her mind about who she was and if her mother was actually her caretaker or her abuser.
Yeah.
Or both, you know?
Right. Because like you said, this kid, Gypsy, is not delayed. She's a bright enough kid.
Yes.
And she's got to come to a point where she realizes what's going on.
Yes. And she must be afraid.
Yeah, I would be. You think, is she going to kill me or something?
Well, that's the thing. Anytime you go to sleep, she could put anything she wants in your stomach.
Yeah.
That's scary. Plus, she did say that she was physically abusive. She would hit her.
Yeah, she would do things to keep Gypsy in line.
Gypsy's diagnoses were listed differently depending on the specialist she was seeing. But a general diagnosis list put together by investigators included epilepsy, impaired vision, hearing impaired, GI reflux, paraplegia, muscular dystrophy, anemia, hypoventilation, asthma, multiple allergies, mental retardation, leukemia, incontinence, lung disease, and a heart murmur.
It's quite a list.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And these are things, I mean, a lot of them are things that you can objectively measure and say yes or no. Some are more by history. So like epilepsy, you could have a normal electroencephalogram but still be suffering from epilepsy. So you got to go on observations by a parent or a caretaker.
But didn't anyone ever think to videotape the hospital room and see if the seizures were actually happening?
Apparently not.
Although I suppose a seizure can be, doesn't have to be a grand mal seizure. It can be subtle.
Sure. The impaired vision and impaired hearing, you would think could be measured easily. But if Dee Dee had said to Gypsy, tell him you can't see the letters or you can't hear the noises, she could be listed as hearing impaired or vision impaired. Paraplegia, well, that shouldn't be too difficult to disprove. Muscular dystrophy is a very easy thing to disprove, although it involves blood tests and muscle biopsies.
Yes, and we'll get to that.
We'll talk about that. Anemia and leukemia are easy to disprove by doing a simple blood test. Asthma, you can do testing to determine whether they're truly asthmatic or not. The retardation part is tougher. Again, if Dee Dee says to Gypsy, don't answer the questions correctly type of thing, I guess she could be listed or determined to be mentally retarded.
Well, I think a lot of these weren't actually diagnosed by anyone. She wrote them down.
These are diagnoses that Gypsy had, according to her mom.
Yeah, if she's taking her to a neurologist, let's say, and says that she has GI reflux, she's hearing impaired, he's not going to look at that kind of thing.
No, he's interested in the seizure part of it.
Right.
Because he's a neurologist.
So I think a lot of this whole pathology is taking her to multiple doctors and misleading them all. But I think you'd agree with me that she definitely was let down by the medical community.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. After Gypsy's father, Rod, had remarried, Dee Dee moved in with her father and her stepmother. They would later claim that Dee Dee, when preparing food for her stepmother, poisoned it with Roundup weed killer, leading to her own chronic illness during this period. So not only do they think she killed her biological mother, but
she
they
was
think...
going after her stepmother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the stepmother survived, right?
She did. And these two were characters, the stepmother and the
her father.
Dee Dee's father and stepmother, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole blue house they were in was funny.
They don't have much nice to say about Dee Dee.
Terrible things. They had nothing good to say about her.
So during this time, Dee Dee's been arrested for several minor offenses, such as writing bad checks and shoplifting. When her father and stepmother began to regularly confront her about her treatment of Gypsy, and they expressed suspicion about her role in her stepmother's health, she took off. She and Gypsy ended up in Slidell, Louisiana, which is a suburb of New Orleans. But they lived kind of under the radar, and her family didn't know they were there for several years. Now, one notable thing is that her stepmother's health returned to normal shortly after Dee Dee moved away. So there's another flag, huh?
Yeah. In Slidell, Dee Dee and Gypsy lived in public housing, and their bills were paid with public assistance that was granted due to Gypsy's medical conditions. But Rod was also making child support payments, which she wasn't claiming. Most of their time was spent visiting various specialists, mostly at Tulane Medical Center and the Children's Hospital of New Orleans, seeking treatment for the illnesses Dee Dee claimed that Gypsy suffered from. Now, a muscle biopsy was done and found no sign of muscular dystrophy. Dee Dee still insisted that Gypsy had it. She just switched doctors.
Yes, that's the easy way, because there's no evidence that she had muscular dystrophy. You got to have an abnormal biopsy. There's this definitive signs on biopsy that would lead you to diagnose muscular dystrophy.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't have it.
Right. But inexplicably, she was successful in securing treatment for these purported medical issues. After she told doctors that Gypsy had seizures every few months, they prescribed anti-seizure medication. Several surgeries were performed on her during this time. And she was also a regular at the ER, bringing Gypsy in for a wide variety of complaints.
Well, you have to, right?
Yeah, but the people at that hospital must have known that she's a frequent flyer and things are unusual.
They did, I'm sure. She's probably on a first-name basis with most of them. But in hindsight, which is always easy, you can say, yeah, she should have been flagged.
I'd say she should have been. Yeah, definitely. I don't think there's much question about that.
No. Uh-uh. I say this reluctantly because it's doctors that dropped the ball on this kid.
Yes, but above all, you're an advocate of patients, not other doctors.
Right.
So I would especially think in pediatrics you have such vulnerable clients that you really have to be looking out for them.
You do.
After Hurricane Katrina in August 2005, according to Dee Dee, she and Gypsy left their ruined apartment for a shelter in Covington. The shelter they arrived at was specially set up for people with special needs. Dee Dee said Gypsy's medical records, including her birth certificate, had been destroyed in the flooding. A doctor there from the Ozarks suggested they relocate her to her native Missouri. So the next month, they were airlifted to Aurora, Missouri. They lived in a rented home there, paid for by a local charity. During their time there, Gypsy was honored as its 2007 Child of the Year by the Olie Foundation. They advocate for the rights of feeding tube recipients. In 2008, Habitat for Humanity built them a small home with a wheelchair ramp and a hot tub as part of a larger project on the north side of Springfield, and then they moved there. The story of a single mother with a severely disabled daughter forced to flee Katrina's devastation, received a lot of local media attention.
I'm sure it did.
It's a heck of a story.
Yeah, isn't it?
And the community pitched in to help Gypsy and her mom. And they knew her as Dee Dee Blanchard.
Yeah, so this outpouring of local support included many charitable contributions. In Louisiana, Dee Dee and Gypsy stayed in the Ronald McDonald houses during medical appointments. And in Missouri, they received free flights to see doctors in Kansas City, free trips to Walt Disney World and backstage passes to Miranda Lambert concerts. And we even have a photograph of Gypsy with the singer. And this was done via the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah, that's just a horrible thing to do. To take advantage of these charities.
You're scamming all these people.
Mm-hmm. Rod Blanchard also continued to make monthly child support payments of $1,200. Rod called only occasionally and talked to Gypsy on the phone. On Gypsy's 18th birthday, when he called, Dee Dee told him not to tell Gypsy that she was 18. She told him that Gypsy thought she was only 14 and he should go along with that, which he apparently did.
Yeah. And at this age, her mom pretty much controls everything and tells Gypsy exactly what she's supposed to say and think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tough.
Rod said that he and his second wife regularly hoped to get to Springfield and visit, but for a variety of reasons, Dee Dee would have to change plans and it wouldn't work out. Dee Dee told her neighbors in Springfield that Gypsy Rose's father was an abusive drug addict and alcoholic who had never come to terms with his daughter's health issues and that he never sent them any money.
Yeah, now the reality is a little bit different from that.
It is.
I mean, maybe he wasn't the most caring, concerned father in the world, but it sounds like he did make repeated attempts to see her, and he made regular child support payments.
Yes, I think he was definitely pushed away by her, not to make excuses for him.
Right.
But she didn't want him around.
No, she didn't.
But many people were charmed by Dee Dee and Gypsy. Gypsy was this little 5-foot-tall, nearly toothless girl with big Coke bottle glasses. Her voice was very high-pitched and childlike, reinforcing the idea that she was younger and that she had multiple disabilities. Dee Dee would regularly shave Gypsy's head to give her the appearance of a chemotherapy patient. She wore wigs or hats. When they left the house, Dee Dee took an oxygen tank and feeding tube with them. So Gypsy was fed mostly with the liquid nutrition supplement Pediasure, even as she entered her 20s.
Yeah, that was her main source of calories. So Dee Dee would use physical abuse to control Gypsy. She always held her hand in the presence of others and never left her alone. And it turns out, whenever Gypsy said something that either suggested she was not really sick or that she seemed to be above her purported mental capabilities, her mother would give her hand a very tight squeeze, just as a warning. And then when the two were alone, she would either hit Gypsy with her open hands or hit her with a coat hanger.
So this is all according to Gypsy. We have no proof of that.
Right. This is Gypsy's story after the murder.
Mm-hmm. Medical interventions did continue. Dee Dee had some of Gypsy's saliva glands treated with Botox and then eventually surgically removed, she said, to control drooling. Tubes were implanted in her ears after Dee Dee repeatedly told doctors that Gypsy had symptoms of ear infections. Now, isn't that easy enough to see if a kid has an ear infection?
It is. So I guess, again, not necessarily defending physicians, but if your history is that this kid has had repeated ear infections, even in the absence of an active infection or chronic fluid in the ears, you might put tubes in. I'm less certain about why they removed her salivary glands.
That's very odd.
I know
that
the history is that she drooled a lot. Boy, that's a pretty drastic surgery.
Isn't it, though?
For drooling.
Well, if anyone had been paying close attention, the signs of Munchausen by proxy were there. Dee Dee attended nursing school for a while and was fascinated with anything medical. That's a big red flag. And she'd worked as a nurse's aide, so she did have a small amount of medical knowledge. From the time her daughter was born, she craved and sought out the attention of doctors and nurses, and it really paid off for her. She received a great deal of positive attention from her role as the courageous single mother of a severely disabled child. She also received plenty of financial rewards.
Yes, she did. So you want to talk about Munchausen by proxy, or do you want to...
Yeah, why don't we do that now? I know that we've talked about it before, but it's been probably close to a year.
It's been about a year.
So let's give the whole background on Munchausen by proxy.
Okay. This is a little bit wordy. Hope you don't mind.
I don't mind.
So we're going to give a little history first. So Baron Munchausen is a fictional nobleman created by the German writer Rudolf Erich Raspe. and this was back in the 1700s. And he wrote a book called Baron Munchausen's Narrative of His Marvelous Travels and Campaigns in Russia. Now, this character is loosely based on a real baron, Hieronymus Karl Friedrich, Freiherr von Munchausen. This real-life Munchausen fought for the Russia Empire in the Russo-Turkish War in the 1700s. Upon retiring from the military, he became a minor celebrity in Germany for telling outrageous tall tales based on his military career. So this is where the background is.
Okay.
Kind of embellishing your resume.
Mm-hmm.
So the fictional baron's exploits, narrated in the first person, focused on the impossible achievements that he had as a sportsman, soldier, and traveler. For instance, he rode on a cannonball, he wrestled a 40-foot alligator, and he traveled to the moon.
Wow.
Pretty tough things to do in the 1700s.
Yeah, but people were easier to fool back then, too.
Well, they just thoroughly enjoyed his stories. So in 1951, a factitious psychiatric disorder came to be called Munchausen syndrome. This is a disorder wherein the people that are affected feign disease, illness, or psychological trauma to draw attention, sympathy, or reassurance for themselves. So they are different from hypochondriacs. Munchausens want people to believe that they actually have the illness. So then in 1977, a British pediatrician named Roy Meadow established the diagnosis of Munchausen by proxy, which he termed a form of child abuse. This is a behavior by an adult towards a child that ensures the child will experience some medical affliction, which will compel the child to suffer through treatments and hospital stays. So this is different a little bit. I mean, we have Munchausen syndrome where the person themselves claims to have an illness, and Munchausen by proxy where the child of the person has the illness. And just for the doubters out there, it is a real syndrome. It's not something made up. And it is a form of child abuse. Okay, so Gypsy eventually saw a neurologist, a pediatric neurologist, in Missouri. This is a doctor named Bernardo Flasterstein. He was seeing her for her muscular dystrophy diagnosis, and he became suspicious. Because usually with muscular dystrophy, you're going to have muscle wasting, which she didn't have. So he's thinking something's going on here. So he ordered MRIs, blood tests, found no abnormalities. So he said to Gypsy, I see no reason why she can't walk. And then he noted that DD was not a good historian. After contacting Gypsy's doctors in New Orleans, he learned that Gypsy's original muscle biopsy had come back negative, which further undermined Didi's claims of a diagnosis of muscular dystrophy. And it also refuted her claim that all of Gypsy's records had been destroyed by the flooding from Katrina. So he suspected the possibility of Munchausen by proxy. Now, Didi wanted to get some access to his notes, I guess as a proactive strike, and she subsequently stopped taking Gypsy to see him. Now, here's the kind of the mistake, I guess.
Well, I mean, the thing is, so she wanted to see the records, and he wrote in the records that she was a poor historian and that he suspected this. And then as soon as she sees that, she doesn't want to see him anymore, right? And the thing...
Because he could be onto her.
Right. So why didn't he follow up by reporting Dee Dee to social services?
Well, that is. And he didn't. Or if he did, it didn't go very far. But I don't think he did. He said he'd been told by other doctors to treat the pair with golden gloves. And he doubted the authorities would believe him anyway. This is... Ah!
Yeah. That's stupid, isn't it?
You can't say that. I mean, you are obligated as a professional. If you suspect child abuse, you report it.
Yes.
There's no gray zone to this. If you think the child is being abused, you report it to the authorities.
Okay. Well, what he tried to say is that it wasn't abuse. It was neglect. He tried to say it wasn't really abuse that he could report. Which
that's just playing with words.
Totally untrue. Right. In 2009, an anonymous caller did tell the police about Dee Dee's use of different names and birth dates for her daughter and suggested Gypsy was in better health than Dee Dee was claiming. Officers who performed the resulting wellness check accepted Dee Dee's explanation, though, that she had used the misinformation to make it harder for her abusive ex-husband to find her in Gypsy. They didn't check this story out with her father, Rod, obviously. And then they went back and reported that Gypsy seemed to be genuinely mentally handicapped and the file was closed. But these policemen were not trained to figure this out.
No, but, you know, you're looking at things that are kind of compartmentalized, right?
Well, that's what she's trying to do, right?
So you don't know about all this other stuff going on. You're just listening to Dee Dee give the explanation of what's going on. And it seems reasonable enough. So you say, okay.
So you mean the neurologist wasn't speaking with the police, who wasn't speaking with, you know, there was just no communication.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they didn't, I mean, not that there was intentionally no communication. They just didn't know that there were these other areas to be investigated.
Well, I don't know. I think that some of them knew. I would definitely think the pediatric neurologist knew to take more steps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did.
Yes.
But he wouldn't necessarily know about the police investigation.
And
he wouldn't know about this anonymous caller talking about Gypsy.
No, but why wouldn't the police contact her physicians with these claims?
Well, I mean, they're looking at a kid that they think has all these things going on.
Yeah, but they have no proof of it.
Well, they have a believable mother who says this is what's going on.
Yeah. Okay.
It's tough.
While those close to Gypsy still believed that she was a teenager, by the 2010s, she was actually an adult. She began to test the limitations of her mother's control. A neighbor recalled an incident in 2010 where Gypsy showed up at her door one night without her wheelchair, seeking a ride to a local hospital to visit a man she was romantically interested in. The man had been assaulted by a group of people familiar with Gypsy's medical history, who thought that he was taking advantage of an underage, mentally challenged girl. At the hospital, Gypsy produced a birth certificate that gave her correct date of birth, proving that she was of legal age. Dee Dee then went to the hospital, where she said that the birth certificate was an incorrect version issued after Katrina, apparently proving it with the real birth certificate, giving a more recent birth date. So they believed that, and Dee Dee made Gypsy apologize.
I'm getting the impression here that things are starting to unravel.
Yes, I mean, she's in her 20s.
This whole web of lies and deceit just is coming apart.
Well, can you imagine going through your teens and into your 20s and being treated like a mental retarded child?
No.
And having to sit in a wheelchair?
I can't.
She clearly wants to grow up and be out in the world. And Dee Dee's well aware of that. She doesn't mind hurting her in that way.
No, she doesn't. I mean, as long as she's getting the attention and the financial support, she's going to keep doing it.
Well, way back in 2001, Gypsy attended a science fiction and fantasy convention, and she was allowed to wear a costume, so she felt like she could blend in more with other people. Then at an event in 2011, she tried to make another escape that ended when her mother found her in a hotel room with a man that she'd met online. Again, Dee Dee produced the paperwork giving Gypsy's false, younger birth date, and she threatened to call the police. Gypsy said that afterward, Dee Dee smashed her computer and her cell phone with a hammer, and that she threatened to do the same to her fingers if she ever tried to escape again. She also punished her by keeping her tied to her bed for about 2 weeks with a dog leash and handcuffs. Dee Dee later told Gypsy that she had filed paperwork with the police claiming that Gypsy was mentally incompetent, leading Gypsy to believe that if she attempted to go to the police for help, they weren't going to believe her. So she's really entering into a trap here.
Yeah, but at the same time, these are things that Gypsy has said after the killing. So
yes,
we don't know exactly how true they all are.
Yeah, but we have no reason to believe anything Dee Dee said.
She's
proved herself as a liar.
But I'm not sure we believe everything a Gypsy says.
True. True enough.
That's all.
Yes.
So somewhere around 2012, Gypsy, who was continuing to use the internet after her mother had gone to bed, made online contact with Nicholas Godjohn, a man around her age from Big Bend, Wisconsin. Gypsy claimed they met on a Christian singles group. There is a Facebook page from that year with their names combined, given their status as in a relationship. And Nicholas had some issues of his own, I would say.
Didn't he, though?
criminal record for indecent exposure, and a history of mental illness.
In 2014, Gypsy confided to Alea Woodmansey, a 23-year-old neighbor, who, unaware that Gypsy was really close to her own age, considered herself a big sister, that she and Nicholas had been talking about eloping. They were getting serious about each other, and they had even chosen names for their potential children. Gypsy, who had 5 separate Facebook accounts, flirted with Nicholas online. Their conversations sometimes included sadomasochistic fantasies. Alea tried to talk her out of running away with Nicholas, thinking that Gypsy was too young and that she was being taken advantage of by a sexual predator. So this is two very damaged people coming together. It can only lead to badness.
This isn't going to be good. No.
Nothing good can come of this. Nicholas had been talking to Gypsy more and more about violent fantasies.
Yeah, an ex-girlfriend of Nicholas has contacted Gypsy online and warned her about Nicholas, but Gypsy dismissed her comments as just the words of a bitter ex-girlfriend. Now, he did have a criminal past. In 2013, he was arrested for watching pornography and fondling himself in a McDonald's for 9 hours. I know this is not something that's funny, but I chuckled about that.
Well, the 9 hours is funny, because which point do you say something?
Yeah. Do you want another bag of fries with that, sir?
Yeah.
Or what?
Well, you know, he's been fondling himself in the corner over there for 8 hours. So at 9 hours, I'm calling the cops.
Yeah, I've had enough.
Yeah.
Now, he gets arrested, and he had a big knife on him when he was arrested.
Well, that's scary. He's a scary guy.
He is. And he also said that he had multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked Gypsy to make up other personalities for herself so his other personalities could have girlfriends. This is almost beyond weird. So most of their interactions were online role play. She had a little girl personality, a slutty personality, and an evil personality.
So this continued for quite a while. And about a year into the relationship, Gypsy confided in Nicholas about her life with her mother. He told her that he would protect her, and over the next year, things progressed into a plan to kill Dee Dee. Gypsy maintained contact with Alea online, and Alea saved some printouts of posts that Gypsy shared with her into 2014 that had been posted between her and Nicholas.
Then in 2015... Gypsy arranged for her mother to meet Nicholas when he came to Springfield. She had this plan where they would just bump into Nicholas while she and Dee Dee were at a movie theater, and they would pretend to develop a relationship from there. Then she could introduce him.
Yeah.
As soon as they did meet for the first time in person, this is an online relationship until then, the two had sex in a theater bathroom.
That's according to Nicholas Godjohn. And this is the only time they'd been together, yeah.
And Gypsy was seeing the Cinderella movie with her mother. Nicholas showed up alone. Now, Dee Dee looked at Nicholas and just absolutely hated him right away. So she thought it was pretty weird that a grown man is coming to see Cinderella by himself.
She has a point there. That's legitimate.
I would think.
Yeah.
Dee Dee said he was a creepy guy and was totally against Gypsy seeing him. This would be the only in-person meeting before Nicholas killed Dee Dee.
So at this point, Gypsy thinks she's in love with Nicholas, and she's very desperate to escape her mother.
Right, her mother had been holding her as a prisoner, abusing her with medication and procedures, and Gypsy had no chance at a normal life with friends, college, or even maybe marriage.
If Gypsy had been raised properly and given normal opportunities, she may have gone on to use Zola for all of her wedding planning and registry needs. Zola is the wedding company that will do anything for love.
Well, that's certainly more than Meatloaf could offer.
For sure. Zola is reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. Zola has everything you love about your favorite department store, plus cool new things like honeymoon funds, fitness classes, wine subscriptions, and so much more. Zola has over 500 brands and 50,000 gifts, experiences, and funds. And Zola is easy to use. They have a top-rated app for your iPhone, iPad, even for Apple Watches. For the less tech-savvy relatives and guests, they have a very friendly customer service team who will walk Grandma and Aunt Lorraine through the registry. Over 300,000 couples have used Zola so far, easily managing their registries from wherever they are. Best of all, Zola Registry automatically integrates into your Zola wedding website, allowing guests to seamlessly shop and get all of your wedding details in one place.
Yeah, for an example, our niece is getting married in the spring. We were lucky enough to use their Zola wedding website to see pictures and plans and to purchase her shower gift. It was easy to navigate, and the selection was amazing.
It was amazing. I was pretty shocked by it, actually. To sign up for Zola and receive $50 credit towards your own registry, go to zola.com/brewery. That's Zola, Zola.com/brewery to sign up for a $50 credit, which goes toward your registry.
So Gypsy and Nicholas continue to talk online about their plans to be together, and these eventually progressed into a plan to murder Dee Dee. Apparently, they had decided that this was the only way for Gypsy to escape and for the two of them to be together. Well, yeah, wouldn't you think so?
I guess.
I mean, the only way we can be together is to kill my mom.
Yeah, and that could have been what she's thinking?
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to fault her for that. Probably she thought that the only way she could be free of her was if Dee Dee was dead.
Well, I think I'd fault her for that. I still don't think it's an excuse for murder. Although, I mean, there's a lot we could talk about with that, so
there's
we'll get
a ton
to that.
Of that.
Yeah.
So that may have been Gypsy's only reason for wanting her mother killed. But Nicholas, on the other hand, seemed like he took pleasure from planning the murder, and he was looking forward to it. He told Gypsy that he wanted to rape her mom before he killed her.
That horrendous.
Jesus.
It's shocking.
Gypsy was disturbed by that idea. Well, God,
I
hope so.
Points for that, huh?
She made a deal with him that he could rape Gypsy in the house after he had killed Dee Dee.
Now Nicholas traveled to Springfield on a Greyhound bus. The next day, Gypsy and Dee Dee had gone to the grocery store, and that evening they painted each other's nails. They stayed up late as Gypsy secretly texted with Nicholas. After Dee Dee was asleep, Gypsy texted Nicholas that she would leave gloves outside the front door for him. She warned him that the door was squeaky so that he should be careful. Gypsy also allowed him into the house and gave him a knife, with the understanding that he would use it to murder her mom. So she's clearly involved. There's no way you can not blame her, at least in part, for this murder.
No, she dictated the terms of the murder.
Yes. Now Nicholas told Gypsy to hide in the bathroom and cover her ears so that she would not have to hear her mother being stabbed to death. She did that, but she could still hear her mother, and she said that her mother called out her name and called for help as Nicholas was attacking her. But Gypsy continued to stay in the bathroom, covering her ears.
Yeah, Nicholas stabbed Dee Dee several times. More than several. A lot of times.
Yeah.
Then he had sex with Gypsy, because that's what he promised her, right?
What she promised him.
Or what she promised him.
He wanted to rape somebody.
And he bit her a couple times. Passion. The two of them packed Gypsy's things, took $4,000 in cash from the house. They ended up in a motel outside of Springfield, staying there for several days and planning to do their next steps.
So what they did is they mailed the murder weapon to Nick's home in Wisconsin, where he lived with his parents. And I guess that was to avoid being caught with it. Then they took a bus to Wisconsin. Several witnesses saw the two of them on their way to the Greyhound station. They said that Gypsy was wearing a blonde wig and that she was walking quite well independently. On the afternoon of June 14th, Gypsy used Nick's phone to post two updates to the Facebook page that she shared with her mom. Now, the first post read, "That bitch is dead," followed 17 minutes later by another post that suggested that whoever left the post had violently killed Dee Dee and had raped Gypsy. Gypsy would later tell the police that she was concerned because several days had passed without anyone discovering her mother's body, and she wanted someone to find the body. So she was hoping that these messages would lead someone to call police and find Dee Dee's body in the house.
So a little bit of remorse, maybe?
Well, a little bit of, yeah, I guess. I don't know how remorseful that is. Maybe a little bit of sympathy.
Yeah, I mean, she wanted the mother, she wanted Dee Dee's body to be found.
That's true, but she's not saying that she's sorry or she's regretting it.
No.
No, she's just saying she wants her body found.
Exactly. So the Blanchards' friends responded to that first post by asking if Gypsy was reacting to a movie she was watching. Some people speculated that her account had been hacked. But after the second post, people knew something was probably very wrong. So after phone calls went unanswered, several of them went to Dee Dee's house.
While they knew that Dee Dee and Gypsy often went on medical trips, they saw that Dee Dee's van, modified to hold Gypsy's wheelchair, was still in the driveway. Plastic film on the house windows made it hard to see inside. When no one answered the door, they went ahead and called 911. When the police arrived, they had to wait for a search warrant to be issued before they could enter the house. They did allow one of the neighbors to climb through a window, where he saw that the inside of the house looked normal, but that Gypsy's wheelchairs were still there and Gypsy wasn't.
Right, but they got the warrant issued and they entered the house and they found Dee Dee's body kind of decomposing. It's been a few days.
Kinda? I'd say definitely decomposing.
Supporters set up a GoFundMe account to pay for her funeral expenses. And maybe Gypsy's also, because they don't know where she is. The concern is that she's been abducted by whoever killed Dee Dee.
Well, yeah, because she's a handicapped child in their eyes.
Right.
And she's gone without her wheelchair, so what you're going to think is someone took her.
Exactly.
The people who knew the Blanchards really feared for her. Even if Gypsy had not been harmed, they believed she would be helpless because she didn't have her wheelchair, she didn't have any of her medications, and she didn't have her oxygen tanks or feeding tube supplies, which, of course, they were convinced that these were necessary things for her.
Yeah, as far as they knew, she couldn't survive without these things.
Mm-hmm. Gypsy's friend Alea, who was on the Blanchards' front lawn with other concerned neighbors that day, told police what she knew about Gypsy's secret online boyfriend. She showed them the printouts she had saved, which included his name. Based on that information, police asked Facebook to trace the IP address from where the post to Dee Dee's account had been made. It turned out to be in Wisconsin. The next day, police agencies raided the Big Bend house. Nicholas and Gypsy surrendered and were taken into custody on charges of murder and felony armed criminal action. The news that Gypsy was safe was a relief to people back in her hometown. She and Nicholas were extradited and held on $1 million bond. But in announcing the news, Greene County Sheriff Jim Arnott warned, "Things are not always what they appear." The media in Springfield later reported the truth, that Gypsy had never even been sick. Arnott warned people not to donate any more money to this family until investigators could learn the extent of Dee Dee's fraud.
Yeah, they have to work on that. So when police arrived at Nick's mother's house in Big Bend, Wisconsin, they found out that Nick had introduced Gypsy to his mom, and he told her that Gypsy had been kicked out of her house and had been living in a homeless shelter. Now, Nick's mother and stepfather had said that the couple acted like everything was fine, and they agreed to let Gypsy live there with Nick. Gypsy's stoic behavior after her mother had been brutally killed by her boyfriend would make many people wonder if she was a sociopath.
So, and I think that's a good possibility.
Well, yeah.
I think you could look at this with a lot of sympathy for her predicament, but you could also look at it like maybe she had no problem doing this.
You certainly could.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, you could.
So Nicholas, on the other hand, was a pretty deviant type of person, but not very intelligent. And Gypsy may have actually been the mastermind behind the murder.
See, that's just something we don't know. Was he luring her into this, or was she totally masterminding it and convincing him, who's not the brightest, to do this for her?
I would think the latter.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, as we'll see, he gets a lot more punishment for this than she does.
Well, I can see that, too.
Well, I mean, it's easy to have a lot of sympathy for her whole life.
Exactly.
If someone
and she didn't participate in the actual killing. She was just there.
She was there. She was giving him the information
and
the tools.
Yeah, but she didn't stab Dee Dee.
No, but she gave him the information to be there and the tools to carry it out.
Yep.
Dee Dee was so manipulative, though. It's probable that Gypsy would have learned how to lie and deceive people, and she had probably become quite skilled at lying just by default, right? Because her mother had made her lie. So I'm sure she had some skill with that.
I'm sure she did. So after they were arrested, Gypsy denied having any knowledge of the plan to kill her mother. See, she's separating herself from Nick. Then she got surprised when all of her texts between her and Nick were revealed. Whoops. There is an enormous amount of evidence against her, including the texts, the murder weapon, stolen cash. Gypsy's defenders would argue that she had a limited capacity to differentiate between what's real and what's not. I would dispute that a little bit. Certainly she had grown up isolated with no understanding of what was normal, but I think she still had a good grasp of what was.
Well, I think she knew right from wrong.
Yes.
But then on the other hand, spending her life the way she did, can we really expect her to be normal and to understand what she's doing like any other person would?
No, I can't.
Yeah. Gypsy's father and his wife ended up being very supportive of Gypsy after the murder. Gypsy pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 10 years in prison with a requirement that she serve 85% of her time before she's eligible for parole.
So she'll do 8.5 years if she stays model.
Yeah, and this is because they have sympathy for what she went through, that they gave her this deal, I would imagine.
Oh, I have to think so.
Because it's a pretty good deal.
It certainly is.
Although, on one hand, I would think being in prison might be better than the life she had beforehand. Because of the long-term abuse that she endured, the prosecution was allowing for mitigating circumstances, and that's why they let her take this plea. Now, things didn't go quite the same for Nicholas Godjohn.
No, he was charged with first-degree murder, and he initially waived his right to a jury trial. But in June, his defense attorney did file a motion for a jury trial, so they ended up with a jury trial. And his trial is going to begin next month, December this year.
So it's taken quite a while.
It certainly has, but wheels of justice move slowly, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
So psychologist Kent Franks of Springfield has told Circuit Court Judge Calvin Holden at a recent hearing that he did 2 mental evaluations of Nicholas. He said Nicholas thought he was doing the right thing when he killed Blanchard because he wanted to rescue Gypsy from her mother. He also said that Nicholas had an IQ of 82 and was in the autism spectrum.
So when you look at it that way, I can kind of think, wow, maybe she manipulated him into doing this. It's hard to say. That's why I think it's just these 2 really damaged people coming together and it ending in a tragedy.
Well, I think that if it wasn't Nicholas, it'd be someone else. I think that Gypsy would have figured out a way to find somebody who she could get to kill her mother, because I think that's what she wanted.
Yeah, you might be right.
So Nicholas was just the first one she hit on, and he agreed to do it.
Well, because most people wouldn't have agreed to do that.
No. But if he had said no, I think she would have gone on to find someone else or someone else or someone else until she eventually found someone who was willing to kill her mother. She just got lucky on the first date.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think she probably could have gone to her father and gotten help.
Well, I think there's a lot of things that she could have done.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, you're right. Mark Feldman, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Alabama, and author of the book Playing Sick, said he's been studying Munchausen by proxy for 25 years, and this is the first case he's seen where the abuse victim murdered her parent. Feldman said he wonders whether a jury would have determined Gypsy Blanchard was justified in killing her mother because of what was done to her. But of course, if she went to trial, she'd be taking a big chance there. She could have gotten life in prison.
She sure could have.
Because they decided not to go for the death penalty. Greene County Prosecutor Dan Patterson has said he believes he could have secured a first-degree murder conviction in this case, and Gypsy would have had to spend the rest of her life in prison. But he didn't believe that was fair because of the abuse she'd suffered at the hand of Dee Dee.
So he's kind of buying into this whole sordid tale himself.
Yeah, I think there's sympathy for her.
There is.
By most people,
yeah.
Even the prosecution.
Once you hear what she did, although, again, a lot of that is hearsay.
Well, yeah, but we know that she made her think she was ill and disabled.
Well, yes, we
know all that's true.
Yeah, I'm not trying to mitigate things. I'm just saying that everything after the murder is based on what Gypsy's told people. And,
yes.
And maybe some family members, what they know secondhand.
Sure. But you know what? The interesting thing is, Dee Dee's family, there is no regret for her death. Nobody cares.
Whoa. I'll say,
they're tough, yeah.
The documentary we watched was, holy cow.
Yeah, they're like, what do you want to do with the ashes? Flush them.
Yeah, they were not Dee Dee fans, were they?
No, so maybe Dee Dee was just a horrible human being, and it's not a tragedy. That's a possibility, I think.
I think so.
Now, Feldman said he believes there are compelling arguments on both sides. I agree with that. And I can see why the prosecutors and the defense had this agreement. I think it's a fair agreement on this 10-year sentence. And
I do, too. I mean, there has to be some guilt assigned to her.
Absolutely.
Nicholas didn't do this all on his own.
No.
So it seems like a reasonable sentence.
I think so. I definitely think so. A couple of things that stand out about this case to Feldman are the length of time that Dee Dee Blanchard abused her daughter and her ability to fool so many people. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, were the doctors fooled? Or did they just pass the buck? How is it possible that doctors didn't realize they were treating a healthy child for illnesses that she didn't suffer from? Dee Dee was able to convince surgeons to perform invasive surgeries on Gypsy. She convinced people to write prescriptions for an entire closet full of medications that were unnecessary. So Munchausen by proxy is child abuse, and doctors are obligated to report it.
But they didn't.
They didn't. Some of this is because there was fragmentization of her care. So she saw a huge number of different physicians.
Yes, but several of them noted that there was something wrong.
Yeah. And I think that somebody should have picked it up, the neurologist in particular.
But, well, yes, because he made a notation on it.
Yeah, but they didn't do it. It's tough if you're not looking at all the records, if you're going by history, which it appears that they were generally doing.
I think you have too much sympathy for these doctors. You're giving them too much credit.
I'm just saying it's difficult.
How difficult is it, really, to do the right thing?
Well, you don't know it's the right thing, necessarily. I think, again, that the neurologist, in my mind, should have made a report.
But a big point here, Dick, is that you don't have to know that the mom is doing it. You just have to suspect, and you need to tell somebody. You need to report
right.
The suspicion.
You do.
Right?
And that's why I'm going back to the neurologist.
Okay, but he's just one that we've heard about. There were several other doctors.
That's true. I mean, I'm not trying to defend doctors necessarily.
Yeah.
Because we're all good guys
anyway.
You
might be a little bit, but okay.
But, you know, if you're... Your informant is this mother who's telling you all these stories about the multiple illnesses and disabilities the kid has, and you don't have access to records. You believe her. So I don't know. I mean, they could have been limited in their ability to do a physical exam by Dee Dee telling Gypsy to act dumb or something.
Okay, but these are highly educated people that should be able to see through that.
Yeah. I think we're not getting too far with this discussion.
Well, I'm just thinking there is a tendency to let this go because you don't want to confront a mother like that, right?
I think that's true.
Okay.
But I also think that you might not have enough information to feel like you could reasonably report the person.
So there has to be a way to fix that. That's a flaw. Christy Blanchard, Gypsy's stepmom, says that they're going to fight to take legal action against the doctors who treated Gypsy. Dee Dee was able to take advantage of the healthcare system, and she thinks, as I do, that this clearly exposes a big flaw in our healthcare system. I mean, it wasn't just one doctor who failed Gypsy here. It was a lot of them.
It was. But what you need is to have access to the records.
Absolutely.
And I think that eventually that's going to happen, that you're going to be able to, by whatever electronic medical record, it's going to be more universal.
I think we're on our way there now.
Oh, we are.
Yeah.
And so you'll be able to access everything. But remember, this is 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think it's tougher.
Well, I mean, it's as recent as 2010 that this was going on with her. So that's not that long ago.
It started in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it was tougher to report back then.
Okay. Well, one idea I had is, should health insurance like Medicaid, which I think most of them get Medicaid in the U.S. because of the huge expenses that go along with a disabled child, right?
Right.
So should Medicaid be monitoring these medical records more closely?
They do.
How about a state-appointed social worker?
There is.
So how did
now,
this get passed?
I don't know about the 90s, but all my patients I have now that have multiple disabilities have a case manager.
And how does that work? Do you think that's working?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It works quite well.
So they can kind of organize the care between doctors?
They organize the care and the things that can be done for the child. So okay. Like if they need physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, the caseworker does that.
But is the caseworker putting together the records to see trends, to look through and see?
Well, that's the other part of it. Hopefully they are.
I think you might need a physician to look over some of those things.
Well, there's got to be a primary care physician.
Okay, which would be you?
Which would be me.
So do you look over the specialist's records?
Well, sure. You're supposed to.
Yeah. So maybe this is some progress we've made since Gypsy was little.
Well, I think there's better communication between physicians. Maybe not direct telephone communication, but at least medical records are more easily found.
Well, and it's hard to say that the medical records were lost now when things are on the cloud.
And they weren't lost in Katrina.
Well, we know that, but it's easier to say back in the paper days.
Right.
So that's just a crazy case.
A sad case.
It is.
I hate stuff like this.
It's really sad, but you can kind of see why this happened. You can see all the things that led to such a terrible outcome.
Oh, you can. Absolutely.
So before we get into feedback, I just want to talk a little bit about what's going on at Tiegrabber, our members-only podcast. We've just released a podcast on the death of Tina Watson, where we have an interview with a scuba diver, which was very enlightening. We have also released other honeymoon cases. And before that, we had our O.J. Simpson case, which was a three-parter. So we have quite a bit built up. We have, I think, over a dozen premium episodes now that are available.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, so if you want to join Tiegrabber, if you think you'd like to give us some support, you'll be able to download them and have yourself a binge. Joining is very easy. You just go to tiegrabber.com and you can sign up. If you don't want to offer support that way, you can also support us on Patreon and listen to our members-only episodes there as a patron. There's also another way to give us some support. The next time you shop Amazon, please go in through the link on tiegrabber.com. Then Amazon will give us a tiny kickback from purchases that you would have made anyway. We won't know what you bought and the prices aren't any different, so this is a great, seamless way to support the podcast, especially now that the holidays are approaching and people are going to be doing their holiday shopping. If you have feedback for us, you can contact us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, on Twitter at tiegrabberpods, on Instagram at tiegrabberpodcasts, also on feedback. We also have a second podcast that you might not know about. It's called Watching ID, where we watch shows on the Investigation Discovery Channel, which is all crime shows, and then we talk about the cases. We recently released one on a disappeared special called Gone in Georgia, and it's all about the disappearance of Kelly Nash in 2015. As always, we appreciate that you listen to our podcasts, and we appreciate your feedback. Thank you for all of your support and for listening each week. One more request, if you have a few minutes, give us a 5-star review on iTunes and tell your friends about the podcast. That really helps us to get more listeners. So that is my spiel for this week. We're going to have a little bit of music and then we're going to do some feedback. You've got a big folder full this week, Dick.
I have a pile of stuff I'm just starting to look through. Holy cow.
Okay, well, I'll put the music in while you sort it out.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome to feedback. So what do you want to start out with, Dick?
I get to go first, right?
Yes.
Okay, I have a suggestion from Brian, who's an English lad, and he's recommending a Canadian crime. This is the murder of Tori Stafford. So Victoria Elizabeth Marie Tori Stafford was a Canadian girl who was abducted from Woodstock, Ontario in April of 2009. She was raped and murdered, and her body was found on July 19th in a wooded area in rural Ontario. Her disappearance and a subsequent investigation and search were the subject of massive media coverage across Canada. Police response to the situation as it developed and their failure to announce an Amber Alert has been criticized by the public and has recently been the focus of a review of the Amber Alert system in Canada.
Oh, interesting.
Circumstances of her death are unknown to the public until a publication ban was lifted in December 2010. So we'll have to look at that. It sounds interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like we could find out a lot from that.
Yeah, I think something that looks at Amber Alerts and reviews how they're applied, that's a great idea.
Okay, sounds good.
What do you got?
I have an update on the Kyron Horman case.
Well, that's an oldie.
Well, yeah, Kyron's a little boy that went missing and his stepmother was a suspect. And this is from Denise. It's news this year about Terry Horman, Kyron's stepmother. So, detectives in Roseburg are investigating allegations of a murder-for-hire plot involving Terry Horman that occurred nearly 30 years ago, long before her stepson Kyron disappeared. He disappeared in 2010. Investigators have long focused on Terry Horman's possible involvement in Kyron's disappearance, but she's never been charged. The alleged murder-for-hire plot targeted a man named Sean Ree, who was Horman's boyfriend at the time. Ree said he remembered a strange man with a gun coming after him, and Terry said, "He's here for you." Records indicate police have known about the murder-for-hire allegations since 2011, but the details have never been made public until this year. Detectives recently presented their case to the Douglas County prosecutor. It's not clear why the case wasn't sent to prosecutors earlier. This report will be referred to the DA's office for review in the near future, and it remains open. The alleged plot occurred in the summer of 1990, when Terry was 20 years old and Ree was 18. Ree said the young couple had ordered Chinese food and sat down to eat at a park near the Horman family home in Roseburg. They were sitting on the grass for about 10 or 15 minutes when a man suddenly appeared. "He came out of the bushes," said Ree. Ree said the man was holding a gun but didn't fire any shots, and he didn't report the incident to police at the time. Ree said he broke up with Terry Horman soon after that incident. He moved away and never spoke to her again. Police unexpectedly contacted Ree in 2011, asking him about Terry Horman. At this time, he was living in eastern Oregon. Multnomah County investigators were investigating the case of Kyron Horman, Terry's missing stepson. Kyron disappeared on June 4, 2010, from Skyline School in northwest Portland. The second grader has never been found. Terry has denied any involvement in Kyron's disappearance. She has never been charged in the case or officially named a suspect. Ree said Multnomah County investigators told him a prison inmate had confessed to taking part in a murder-for-hire plot decades ago in Roseburg. He called the investigators, telling him the unnamed inmate independently provided specific details that matched his account. Ree said detectives drove him back to Roseburg in 2011 to identify the park where the incident allegedly occurred. He said he was also called to testify before a grand jury. He didn't want to appear on camera with the local news KGW, but he did speak to them over the phone. And he said that he's frustrated that this case hasn't moved forward. Now, Terry lives in California now. And also remember, she was accused by a landscaper of trying to hire him to kill Kyron's dad, Kane. Remember that?
Yeah, she has a checkered history, doesn't she?
She does. Then, when he went back to her wearing a wire, she got suspicious and backed out. That's why there's no arrest with that one. But she definitely is suspicious. And yeah. The last one seen with little Kyron.
Well, we suspect her.
Absolutely. That's a super sad case.
It sure is. Well,
terrible person she is.
A little kid.
Cute little kid, I know.
Okay, I have another recommendation. This is from Jim. He recommends this case from California. This is a kidnapping of Hannah Anderson. So in August of 2013, 16-year-old Hannah Anderson was abducted after cheerleading practice from Sweetwater High School in National City, California.
The suspect, I remember that?
The suspect was later identified by authorities as 40-year-old James DiMaggio, owner of a home in Boulevard, California, which is about an hour away, where Anderson, her mother Christine, and brother Ethan had been overnight guests the previous evening. The bodies of Christina and Ethan Anderson and their family dog Callie were later found in DiMaggio's burned home. An Amber Alert was issued for Hannah Anderson, who was found alive in Cascade, Idaho, about a week after she was abducted. DiMaggio was with her and was killed by FBI agents during a shootout in Idaho, and he'd been camping with her. So this is some kind of sick bastard.
Yes, he was in love with her.
He focused on Hannah.
Yes, and some hikers saw the two of them up in that area.
Out in the deep woods.
So it took a while to get her back.
Yeah, but she survived.
She did, but just think what she has to deal with now.
Yeah, her mother and brother are dead.
Yes. So I have an update or some questions about the Lauren Spear case, and this is from Simone. And Simone says, I'm binge listening. Why? Because why not? So I have an opinion on a case. Let me preface it by saying I've never been to college, I've never done drugs, and although I am a nurse, I'm not a cardiac nurse. So with that put that way, my opinion is on the Looking for Lauren case. I know it's old, but my gut says to me that Lauren overdosed and died by accident. Here's how I think it played out. Lauren has long QT and she was doing drugs. I think maybe she did her cocktail, which she had done in the past to induce the lightheaded feeling associated with the ventricular tachycardia. Perhaps the feeling was somewhat similar to those who engage in breath-holding sex games. She self-corrects by taking her beta blockers so the rhythm doesn't convert to a deadly ventricular fibrillation. Perhaps on this night the combo of the cocktail was off and she took it too far. Given people think she looked more affected than she should have at the time of her disappearance, I suspect she collapsed on the street and died from VF induced by the drugs she took. In terms of why they didn't find her body, perhaps someone who had something to lose, such as their freedom, stumbled across her and in self-preservation mode disposed of her body. Of course, none of this can be proven without a confession or a body, so it's all just a gut feeling. It's sad because if someone had walked with her and she collapsed, she might not have disappeared or collapsed and died. But I would go further to say I don't think any of her friends or associates were aware of her heart condition, so I doubt they could be held responsible for anything more than being shitty mates. Anyway, it's the first case I've had a real gut feeling about, so I had to share. Thank you for the awesome podcast. Thanks, Simone.
Yeah, we like that.
So an interesting addendum to this is 3 weeks ago, Lauren's parents posted some information on a possible connection between the murder of Hannah Wilson and Lauren's disappearance. Overwhelmed by the response to his statement regarding the disappearance of Indiana University student Lauren Spear, Brown County prosecutor Ted Adams shed a little light on his theory that Daniel Messel, a man he helped convict in the 2015 murder of another IU student, Hannah Wilson, could be responsible for the disappearance of Lauren Spear. Wilson's body was found near Plum Creek in Brown County, and Messel's cell phone was discovered at her feet. Police found Messel at his home with a garbage bag of bloody clothes and his Kia Sportage splattered with blood. Messel was sentenced to 80 years in prison, including 20 years for being a habitual offender. So Adams said, I'm not an investigator, nor do I possess any formal training. I'm not a part of the Lauren Spear investigation. This matter is out of my jurisdiction. I do not have access to any of the information possessed by professionals at the Bloomington Police Department, and hence I cannot comment whatsoever as to the evidence or lack thereof. I'm a simple prosecuting attorney who readily admits to possessing tunnel vision when commenting on the disappearance of Lauren Spear. My admitted tunnel vision focuses on one individual who I convicted of brutally murdering Hannah Wilson. The individual is Daniel Messel, a convicted murderer who demonstrated, in my opinion, a pattern, a signature known as a modus operandi. As a person who lived with the task of convicting Daniel Messel for the murder of Hannah Wilson, I developed an opinion based on what I had learned of Daniel Messel's modus operandi, and this still remains just my opinion. So he went on to reveal how it came to be his opinion, with details dating back to 2012, the year after Lauren disappeared, and 3 years before Hannah Wilson was killed. The Indiana State Police and the Brown County Prosecutor's Office was tasked with piecing together a timeline for Daniel Messel on the night of April 23, 2015, and on the morning of April 24, 2015. At the same time, the team attempted to determine what Daniel Messel's motive was, what possessed a man to select a beautiful and promising young co-ed and kill her. Our investigating revealed a chilling modus operandi. We discovered 5 women who were systematically harassed and in one case sexually assaulted during the summer and fall of 2012. These women believed the individual harassing them was none other than Daniel Messel. I attempted to submit testimony of the young woman who was sexually assaulted in November of 2012, but the judge ruled this evidence as inadmissible. Our witness was unable to identify Daniel Messel as the man who assaulted her. She was unable to identify him in 2012 when making a police report. This prevented the Bloomington Police Department from moving the case forward. What these women could identify was consistent with either Daniel Messel or a vehicle consistent with Daniel Messel. There are attempted rape charges pending against him from an allegation stemming from an assault in September of 2012 in the same area as these other women. The police were able to assist the Indiana State Police in identifying Daniel Messel's cell phone number when it was found underneath Hannah Wilson's body. Messel's number was on file because he had called dispatch at 4 a.m. and in the same area as the harassment and stalking cases in 2012. Hannah Wilson disappeared from her home on 8th and Grant Street in the early hours of April 24th. These contacts demonstrated a modus operandi of harassment and assault from as far west as Walnut Street to as far east as Dunn Street, and from as far north as 10th Street and as far south as Kirkwood Street. Adams labeled this area as Messel's zone of danger. Lauren Speer was last seen heading south towards 10th Street, the northern edge of this danger zone, and we know that she was intoxicated and she was alone. It would cause me great torment to know that the current press regarding Daniel Messel would assist in a change of venue. I will respectfully decline any further interviews in an effort to allow his current criminal case to be brought to resolution. Adams also added, I believe it goes without saying that the police department continues to work diligently to solve the mystery surrounding Lauren Speer's disappearance and to bring closure for not only Bob and Charlene Speer, but for the entire community. Speer spent a late night out with friends and was last seen around 12:30 a.m. June 3, 2011, when she left her apartment at Smallwood Plaza. Her boyfriend, Jesse Wolf, sent a text message to Speer several hours later. When an employee of the bar, where Speer left her phone, responded to the text, that's when she was reported missing.
Well, that's an interesting case. I'm not sure how you can relate the two of them.
Well, he thinks that this is something that Daniel Messel would have done, and he was in the area. That was the area where he was victimizing women.
But the other case has a woman who was brutally murdered, blood all over the place, as they said, and 5 or so other women who said they were stalked or sexually assaulted by him, which sounds completely different from what happened to Lauren Speer.
Well, we don't know what happened to Lauren. She could have been brutally murdered, and her body just hasn't been found. But you mean that he didn't hide the other body?
Right.
Sure. But I think it's interesting that a predator like that was in the area, and she was alone and under the influence. Certainly something worth thinking about.
Yeah, she was. But yeah. I think we were at the opinion, as our person who wrote the note, Simone, that it was kind of an accidental death, that she overdosed and had an arrhythmia that was fatal.
I know, but these stories where someone dies accidentally and then friends or family hide the body, that's just so far-fetched to me. If you're a normal person,
well,
you don't do that.
That's the difficulty I have, is that, so, yes, she did this and died, then why don't you call the police or something?
And would some school kids be that great at hiding her body that she wouldn't be found?
Yeah, I know. But I think they could have.
Well, it's possible, sure. But I think maybe this predator is a more likely answer. I don't know. I just always find it far-fetched when people say, well, something went wrong and they died, and so someone hid the body. That sounds crazy.
That's true. That's the only part that's tough for me.
Yeah.
But this guy, Missile, sounds like he's pretty clumsy.
Sure.
And if he had killed Laura Spear, that you would have known that you would have recovered a body or something.
Perhaps. But just remember, she was tiny. She'd be easy to take somewhere. She was like 4'11", 90 pounds.
I mean, his killing of the other woman just doesn't sound real organized.
No, it doesn't. I'm not saying they're identical, but there could be a connection.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
We don't know, but I think it's just worth mentioning.
I think so.
Okay.
Okay, moving on. I got a note from David P. on Love and Madness, which was the story of the Fritz and Susie.
Yes.
Killing the kids.
Killing a lot of people, including the kids.
Right. So David P. says, I saw the 1984 movie on this case. I really believe the North Carolina police and social services should have been held accountable for the sad deaths of these two boys. I think the reality that they could have been spared if the authorities properly intervened should have been more prominent in the podcast, although I do think it was very well done and thought out. My question is, after the four were blown up in the police pursuit, I have to wonder if there was no investigations with social services, the police, and a lack of teamwork between the North Carolina and Kentucky police. Well, we did comment on that.
On what?
The latter part.
That the Kentucky police collaborated?
No, that there was no communication.
Well, they didn't collaborate until after Susie's family was killed, and the father of the boys went to the Kentucky police and told them.
Exactly.
But they did cooperate after that. But I definitely agree with Dave about social services, and those boys were let down. That didn't need to happen.
They were. This is a case that cries out for full investigation, disclosure, firings if necessary, and new operating procedures to make sure this never happens again. Although Fritz killed the boys, I hold the state authorities responsible for their lack of action in a case that clearly called for removing the children from the apartment. I find it astounding that family members were being killed at will during the course of a custody battle, but authorities did not safely protect the boys while all this was going on.
Absolutely.
We agree.
Yeah. I mean, they knew that Fritz was their guy.
Yeah.
And yet they waited until he was coming out of the house with the children. Now they claim they thought the kids were at school.
That's what they said.
But to me, that's no excuse. And, you know, by the way, it was 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So they may have been home from school by then anyway, if they'd gone to school.
Right.
But they knew that this was a crazy environment where bad things were happening.
They knew that Fritz was nuts.
They knew that he'd murdered these people.
And that they had good cause to believe that he murdered. I mean, they didn't know.
Well, even if they weren't ready to arrest him, they should have taken the kids.
But they had a pretty good idea, and they should have moved quicker.
Yes, definitely. It was really bungled.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a comment from Lee L., and this is our last piece of feedback. So this is about Steve DeMucker in the episode An Inconvenient Woman. On codependence, we all have to some degree a little healthy narcissism and a little of what we call altruistic narcissism. There's a reason that a classic narcissist will look for someone who is altruistic, as they are less likely to maintain healthy boundaries. Narcissism does not spring from absolutely nowhere, and I think being the first of 9 children was in essence the inevitable emotional neglect that led to a compulsive need for attention. And on our comments about Charlotte being a spoiled teen, she says, that is not being spoiled, that is brainwashing from a narcissist parent. The mother was scapegoated. Same thing as with your podcast on the Farrar arson killings. So I think Lee has a great point there. Definitely Steve DeMucker had brainwashed Charlotte. Maybe not the older daughter quite as much because she was more independent, but he definitely brainwashed Charlotte against her mother. even though they seem to have been coming together right at the time of her death.
No, I don't think there's any question. I'm not sure exactly how to respond to that opening stuff.
Well, I kind of think that she's saying a narcissist is going to look for someone altruistic, like Carol Kennedy was a very peaceful, loving, altruistic, love everybody type of person, it seems. So a narcissist would be attracted to that because they're not going to maintain their own boundaries and have rules about things, and the narcissist can kind of run them. That's what I took from it.
Okay. I can go with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point.
And the point of Charlotte being spoiled. Yeah, I think that she probably was influenced. I wouldn't say brainwashed, but influenced by her father. And I think that there was some of that on Charlotte, that she chose to disavow her mother.
Well, sure, but she was a teenager.
Yeah, it's a tough age, isn't it?
And she clearly looked up to and admired her father. And her father must have been telling her, you know, your mom won't pay for your college. She's going to blow the money away.
Yeah, no, I'm sure he was continually running down the mother.
If Steve DeMocker was able to manipulate all these grown women, girlfriends, wife, all of that, can we really blame Charlotte if she was influenced and manipulated by her own father, who was a narcissist?
No, I don't think so. She was in the same boat.
Yeah, so she sounded like a spoiled brat, but we can see why
that
happened.
Okay.
Because it was maybe not brainwashing, but definitely a heavy influence from her father. And as she added at the end, it's the same with the Farrar arson killings, which, to me, in a much more dramatic way.
Yeah, way more dramatic.
Yeah, she had really influenced her children against their father.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Lee, and all of our feedback contributors. We'll be back in another week with more True Crime Brewery.
See you next time. We'll be at the quiet end. Come visit.
Okay, bye-bye.